Welcome to American Countdown this Monday, June 8th, 2020. Tonight we're going to be discussing the witchcraft of the riots. If you look at some of the headlines from this weekend, you find stories like this one from the Chicago Sun-Times. 85 shot, 24 fatally over Chicago's most violent weekend yet. Maybe that had something to do with police wanting to have the Ferguson effect of backing off of interventions while the violence and the looting and the gang and the criminal activity accelerates and escalates. Indeed, in that same context, you see headlines like D.A. Vance from New York, New York City, Manhattan, declining to prosecute anyone arrested during the various rioting and looting activity that has taken place. In the same context, in fact, you had that headline from prosecutors in St. Louis, Missouri. You had it from police captains and police chiefs in Dallas, Texas. You had it in a range of cities, counties, and states across the country, to the degree that Minneapolis is now announcing it is going to disband its entire city police department. That's right. The BLM agenda of defund the police has now become an actual public policy recommendation and proposal in a major city in America. They have not exactly explained what it is that's supposed to replace it, beyond suggesting that merely calling 911 might be a sign of white privilege. That is the status of where things exist. You might think they were the product of some kind of witchcraft to see this sort of insanity and criminality seize our cities. In fact, there were riots in Brussels and Belgium. There were riots in London. There were riots in Paris. There was violence all across the world in some shape or form connected to these events and connected to these groups and connected to these mantras. In fact, including in London itself, where more than 27 officers were injured just this weekend, and what the BBC still called mostly peaceful protests, despite all of those people getting injured and hurt. They were even throwing rocks at horses and knocking people off that caused major damage. CNN changed the headline to "Horse Goes Crazy at Local Protest." That is the kind of media coverage that has taken place in what looks like something that only could be brought up in a sort of in a witch's maelstrom. Well, in that context, in this case, there's actually a literal connection to some of this behavior and some of this conduct and some of the witchcraft, if you will. Take, for example, the Wikipedia entry for one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, the group, Patrice Cullors. She's identified as a co-founder of Black Lives Matter. In fact, in some context, she's defined as and described as the founder of Black Lives Matter. And what's interesting is something that is later on in the Wikipedia entry that you'll see occasionally pop up in news stories about several of the co-founders of BLM. It's that she developed an interest in the Nigerian religious tradition of Ifa, incorporating its rituals into political protest events and trying to tap its quote-unquote spirituality to influence these political protest events. Well, what exactly is the Ifa tradition? Well, Ifa stems from the Yoruba religious tradition of Western Africa, which is, in fact, partially the foundation for things like Santeria and, as we know it more popularly here, voodoo. That's some of the ideological and intellectual strains and ancestry of the Ifa religious tradition. Indeed, in this article called African Spirituality Now, it describes it as witchcraft, divination, and healing. They even have a Yoruba word for witch, aye, in which they sometimes call them elders or mothers. Indeed, it's like a scene out of the film from Angel Heart, as we'll show right here.
Thank you.
African spirituality article details many systems of what they call divination, and divination has another word in some contexts, otherwise called witchcraft by many. Of the many systems of divination used by the Yoruba, the most important is Ifa. So Ifa is what the Black Lives Matter co-founders described as being deeply part of and finds her spirituality from and uses, in her own words, to influence her political protest movements and activities. Yoruba magical techniques and rites are prescribed by the various forms of activities in their religious tradition. And in fact, the Yoruba word Ogun refers to either magic or medicine. It's seen as indistinguishable and exchangeable with any other. So you actually have someone, now you might have a guess as to why BLM does not have tight ties to the Black Protestant Church or the Nation of Islam when its co-founders are deeply involved in religious traditions that have connections to things like voodoo and Santeria. Indeed, this trend has become an increasing trend, so much so that The Atlantic referred to the article as, quote, the witches of Baltimore, describing how increasingly within parts of the sort of neo-Marxist African-American political tradition and other political traditions are increasingly involved in various kinds of what others would be seen as witchcraft. Indeed, from this article, modern Black witches are practicing Yoruba-based faith with a few millennial touches. Describes it how its connections to Santeria, to Candomblé, to Voodoo, to all of the other various branches of the Yoruba-based religious traditions. But this gives you an idea. Many Black witches, nervous about practicing witchcraft openly, feel more comfortable meeting online than in person. Indeed, you'd have to wonder whether the co-founders of Black Lives Matter, who knew each other before they started it and created it, there has been discussions in some parts of public media space that several of them have been deeply involved in this tradition. So you have the possibility of actual witches involved in running Black Lives Matter. That's how insane the world has become. In that same capacity, if we look at, that might help explain not only the kind of conduct that has been taking place, the kind of result you might expect when people decide to use their witchcraft to influence political protest, but it also explains either the lack of an agenda or where there has been an agenda, the radical destabilizing characteristics of that agenda. Indeed, if you go back to the 2016, where Black Lives Matter released its policy agenda, many of it are things like calling for collective employment, collective means of ownership, basically neo-Marxist solutions. Indeed, they say, quote, we seek radical transformation. And their goal was to have radical result as a consequence. This is why you don't see calls for simple civil rights solutions. This may also explain why the Black business class is generally not involved in Black Lives Matter, because there's an anti-capitalist tendency within the neo-Marxist influences of the movement. Now, they're happy to take donations from big corporations and billionaires, but that doesn't stop or limit or constrict their desire to completely undo the American experiment. They see issues of race and issues of police as a pretext to take apart America and all of its institutions, not as a means of substantive reform that can improve everybody's agenda within the infrastructure or system that we have. Of course, Americans don't want to defund police. Indeed, as polling surveys show, between 70 and 90% of African Americans are satisfied and happy with their local police force. It is only a small minority that is actually upset and agitated to a degree that they would even consider or contemplate such radical institutional change as now is being publicly and popularly discussed, not only in Minneapolis, but in cities, counties, and states across the country, and by leading Congress members of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, including Rashid Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, and AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Meanwhile, different people are going along with aspects of this agenda. As the Dallas police chief says, she won't file any criminal charges against more than 600 people arrested for various illegal activities during the riots and looting and protests that took place. A looter did break into a Philadelphia gun store overnight, but he was surprised to meet the owner there with an M4, so that theft didn't turn out as expected. Indeed, there's more and more people arming themselves to defend their property and defend their homes all across the nation, something that makes even more sense when you're in an environment where people are talking about defunding and destroying the local police force. Indeed, sort of the nature and The Nature of Chaos and Anarchy as Tools of Communist Subversion was the headline of an article from the Epoch Times. It went into the long history of these tools and techniques and tactics as methods that subversives have used to undermine societies and civilizations for the last 200 plus years. Indeed, in that context, it's useful to go back to when this sort of really began in part, and that is with the French Revolution. The French Revolution followed not long after the American Revolution and originally had good purposes and principles attached to it. That's where the famous tricolors came about, tricolore, as well as the three phrases of liberty, equality, and fraternity, founded by people like Danton and others. Indeed, Thomas Paine, who wrote Common Sense and was a critical part of the American Revolution, was there in Paris during the French Revolution. But quickly it got off its hinges because it lost its connection to tradition or the past or to history that is a common denominator in radical revolutions that end up devouring their own. They disregard local institutions. They disregard their local communities' traditions. They disregard either the religious or economic orientations of their population. Instead, they want a radical break from the past, a complete departure from the past, a complete assault and attack on the past. That is why you so commonly see them wanting to destroy buildings, wanting to destroy statues, wanting to ultimately destroy people. The French Revolution was the first of this, and one of the reasons why it got out of hand so quickly was because the mob is what helped instigate it in the first place. So they learned the wrong lessons. The leaders of the French Revolution decided, in the name of this radical departure from the past that would reject and annul the past, that their key tools of power would be to leverage the mob and to leverage terror, and in particular to leverage the mob inflicting terror. Indeed, they even called it the Reign of Terror. And in that context, people like Robespierre and Marat and Danton would become famous. Gerard Depardieu would even play Danton in a later great French movie after his role in Cyrano de Bergerac made him a worldwide international star. Indeed, in that context, we've seen a wide range of such behaviors start to embed within other aspects of the way the world has developed. A good history of the French Revolution. Here's a little good clip. Let's play clip number 28.
Danton and Robespierre, the star orators of the National Convention, realize that only drastic new measures can save the revolution. They convince their colleagues to institute a new form of martial law. It is time for all Frenchmen to enjoy sacred equality, announces Danton to the convention. It is time to impose this equality by signal acts of justice upon traitors and conspirators. Make terror the order of the day. It is the founding moment of the revolution's most infamous episode. The terror will come to symbolize Jacobin extremism and the corruption of revolutionary ideals. To meet the emergency, the new constitution and the rights it guarantees are suspended. Police spies scatter throughout the country. Anyone suspected of counter-revolutionary activity is rounded up, quickly tried, and executed.
The Reign of Terror was conceived as an emergency government. What they understood by terror was striking terror into the hearts of the enemies of the Republic so that they would be either scared straight, as it were, or arrested and disposed of.
The slightest suspicion can send anyone to the scaffold. Politicians who say a kind word of the extinguished monarchy. Anyone who uses the formal monsieur or madame instead of the new form of address, citoyen, citizen. Informers are everywhere. Neighbors denounce neighbors. The incessant rolling of the tumbrils en route to the guillotine rattles through the streets of Paris.
Execution is absolutely hanging over people's heads in the sense that we know in Paris there are police spies, and there are quite a few police spies everywhere, standing in bread lines, listening to what the women are saying, and turning them in if they don't like what they hear. You could be turned in not just for complaining about the high price of bread, but you could be turned in supposedly even for not being enthusiastic enough about where things were going and the success.
You could be turned in for not being enthusiastic enough sort of sounds like what we've been seeing on some of the streets and in some of our city halls and elsewhere over the last week. Indeed, this structure of using street violence, of using mob terror to create as a leverage of power, as a tool of power, would continue through the 19th century. The Paris Commune would take over in 1848. The name communist comes from those who took over the Paris Commune. Later after that, because of that, the reason why Paris has its grand boulevards is because Napoleon III decided he didn't want to see another Paris Commune occur. He didn't want to see another mob control of the streets occur. So he took away all the small little streets and back alleys they used to have and created the beautiful grand boulevards they now have to preclude that kind of street violence from being impactful or easily effective in the future. But that didn't stop it from occurring. We had our own anarchist riots, the Haymarket riots and bombings of the 1890s here in the United States. That violence would continue in various forms with the communists taking it up in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s. Indeed, in fact, there's a reason why if you type in anywhere, May Day riots, reflecting the 1st of May, the day that the communists celebrate because of its historical Labor Day associations, you'll find riots all across the 20th century, all across the world. You'll find them in Tokyo, you'll find them in Paris, you'll find them in Berlin, you'll find them in Italy, you'll find them in parts of the United States, you'll find them in Latin America, Central America, even occasionally spotting coming up in Africa and Asia. That is how wide-scale it is. It became such a common tactic and technique that it was, in fact, the way in which the 20s and 30s it was born in Europe. Indeed, and to a large degree, the fascists were a response to the communists, not the communists as a response to fascists. The communists, the end of World War I, which had such a destabilizing effect, the true peak of internationalism brought us into World War I, and in fact, it was so devastating and destabilizing across the Western European continent that it would ultimately give us the Great Depression, it would give us the rise of communism, it would give us the rise of fascism. Communism first arose in the Soviet Union in 1917, where they often used street violence and gangs to achieve their political power. The White Civil War, as it was called in Russia, would go on for years and years and years because of the internal conflict over the Russian Revolution. But those street tactics would spread to places like Germany and elsewhere. Indeed, it was particularly common in places like Berlin in the 1930s. If we take a look at clip number 38, we'll see a clip of some of the communist street violence that you can find at places like British Path, in other words, and other locations that maintain old video archives of news information, and it's of communists and fascists fighting in the street. Notably, their most popular sign, their most popular image right there, that very first one, has on it a flag that is the Antifa flag today. That goes all the way back to the 1920s before the Nazis had seized control over Germany. The communists called themselves and rebranded themselves anti-fascist in the late 1920s, to justify and legitimize their violence, to justify and legitimize their street rioting. That's where the idea originated. It wasn't in response to fascists. It was a political pretext before fascists had even achieved power to justify them. Communists have always needed fascists, and fascists have always needed communists in order to achieve and attain power. That's why Charlottesville was so significant and consequential in the mythology of the anti-Antifa movement here in the United States. You can see the flag is the same. Basically, the image is the same. The only difference is they changed it from the German to English. It sounded more honest in its original German, just like Bill de Blasio's statements about not allowing Orthodox Jews to worship in New York City about a month ago. And in that same context, it would ultimately culminate in its most extraordinary form in China in the 1960s. After Mao Zedong seized power after World War II, using his fighting against the Japanese to obtain it, he was in part armed with U.S. arms because they made a compromise deal with China to go at Japan, much as we did with the Soviet Union, to go after the Nazis. Mao Zedong seized power, and as part of that seizing power, he did a great leap forward. It's the problem of one guy coming up with power all at once. And as Mao Zedong seized power in the 1950s in China, what he did was the Great Leap Forward, which led to mass starvation. He had this ingenious idea, more likely an insane idea, to have everybody try to make steel in their own backyards It led to most of the adult population not working the fields, which led in turn to a massive famine, which probably killed, they don't know how many because they didn't keep honest stats, probably approximately 40 million people within a four-year time frame. He was killing about 10 million people a year. In order to deal with that, increasingly people within the communist bureaucracy began to doubt whether Mao was such a genius after all. And that led Mao to be worried that the middle tier of the power structure would come after him and take him out. So he decided to unleash the children, the teenagers, the kids, in what would become to be called the Chinese Cultural Revolution. Indeed, if you've recently heard references to struggle session, that refers to a language that came about during the Cultural Revolution, where they would put their teachers on trial. They would put their parents on trial. They would put any intellectual on trial. Anybody that had any degree of status whatsoever that coincidentally could be perceived as a threat either to them or to Mao would have to go out and publicly confess. I'll give you an example of some of the scenes from this and some of the admissions about this. If we take a look first at clip number 29.
All ideas contrary to Mao's thinking and the objects that represented them had to be destroyed. Not just Confucianism and Buddhism, but even more so foreign faiths like Christianity. Throughout the country, churches were closed, clergy unfrocked, religious symbols smashed. The statue of the Virgin Mary was replaced by a portrait of Mao. One form of worship gave way to another.
It has to become a better world, and of course it didn't. It became a much worse world.
The physical destruction wrought by the Red Guards was unparalleled even in China's long history. Monasteries all over the country, as far away as distant Tibet, were ransacked and razed to the ground. The most important sites, like the Forbidden City, were protected on the orders of Zhou Enlai. But elsewhere, Mao's stormtroops had free rein. Zhou Enlai's implicit distinction between smashing bourgeois ideas and smashing bourgeois individuals was quickly forgotten. Over the next few weeks, tens of thousands of people in Beijing were harangued and severely beaten. Many hundreds died.
I can remember as though it were yesterday watching a group of strongly built students, including some of my own classmates, boys who practiced martial arts, jump up onto the platform.
1928, until he dared to criticize the chairman's great leap forward, was dragged out and publicly vilified. To his Red Guard accusers, Peng was a free antis element, wasteful, corrupt, and bureaucratic, disloyal to Chairman Mao. Jiang Wentian, Mao's predecessor as party leader in the 1930s, was damned alongside him. Both men had devoted their lives to the Chinese Revolution. Now, they have no rights. Who was undergoing a slow descent into hell? The highest-ranking victims were brought out for public humiliation before mass meetings in a football stadium. They wore placards around their necks with their names crossed out, like common criminals awaiting execution. Wu Han was a playwright, one of whose works angered Mao. The chairman used it as a pretext to overthrow Wu's patron, the mayor of Beijing, Peng Jun. The purge he'd set in motion would eventually claim other victims, still higher in the chain of command. Meanwhile, Peng and his colleagues were left to twist in the wind.
Indeed, let's look at just another clip of just one of the people talking about what they did during the Cultural Revolution. Let's take a look at video clip 32.
In 1966, Chairman Mao Zedong launched the Cultural Revolution. He told Red Guards to attack those in authority who had strayed from the true communist path. At Amy Lee's school, 15 and 16-year-old children who were Red Guards turned on their teachers, forcing them to run round in circles.
Run round the playground, the sports ground. Run. If one is too tired or whatever, fell over, you just kick it. Kick him or kick her. Most of our teachers are women. And all use belt to belt them. Oh. One teacher asked, can we have some water? And some Red Guards don't know where they get a little bucket. It's urine. Said, drink this. And she said, this is, can't drink it. Then they just kick, bash. The urine was actually powered to her face. And then another one got some waste, said, any one of you are hungry?
Miss Liang was the Communist Party representative at the school, the party secretary. Amy was next door as Miss Liang was beaten by young Red Guards.
Miss Liang was shouting, crying, said, you shouldn't do this. This is not right. And I'm revolutionary. Our party secretary was beaten to death that night.
They turned in their parents. They turned in their teachers. They often led the beating. In fact, people were involved as young as 5, 6, 7 years old, being taught to accuse, and the insanity that wrought and led to the deaths of tens of millions of people, more on top of that had been killed in the famine before. It only fully stopped and ended when, fortunately for the people of China, Mao Zedong finally died. That was the only time it stopped. We'll be coming back and we'll be talking with Cassandra Fairbanks, who's personally experienced some of the insanity of the left, been a target of some of the insanity of the left, Antifa and other groups, personally and online. We continue to encourage you to support our sponsor that makes this platform possible. Go to InfoWarsStore.com, where you can get products like Chill Force and other supplements and health products, coffee, protein bars, whatever you like. Right now it is on sale at approximately 60% off, almost across the board. So get it now while you still can and support programs like this to keep freedom alive. Welcome back to American Countdown. Tonight we have as our guest Cassandra Fairbanks, who has personally experienced a wide range of the unique mentality of the modern millennial left in all of its forms and incarnations. Cassandra, glad you could be with us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Sorry, I'm a mess. I'm moving.
Hey, no problem. In that capacity, my recollection is that you first sort of shot onto the social media scene in an apolitical context. A story about the dancing man. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I was involved in political things before that. I was, you know, a big WikiLeaks supporter and things. But dancing man was, there was a man who was being made fun of online for being heavier and dancing. Somebody took a picture, posted it to 4chan, making fun of him. I got together with a bunch of my girlfriends and we decided we were going to throw him a dance party, flew him out to LA. There were tons of celebrities involved. We found him in like 6 hours thanks to Twitter. Still friends with him to this day. So, yeah.
And then later on, you ended up becoming active in various left-leaning movements, including going to Ferguson. Could you describe what your life was like during that time period and what you witnessed in Ferguson?
Well, I worked for a libertarian website, which was really against militarized police. And at this time, you know, BLM wasn't really a thing yet. It was kind of being built then. So we were seeing tanks and stuff on the ground, and we were like, oh, my gosh, I got to go. So I went and I covered that. Got pepper sprayed in the face a few times. It was, you know, scary situation, very similar to what we're seeing now. But
and would you say at that point in time you were more on the anti-police or police skeptical side of the political equation?
Yeah, I mean, I've been obsessed with Waco and Ruby Ridge and stuff forever. So seeing tanks driving down the street, I was like, oh my gosh, this needs to stop, you know, and I still feel that way to some degree when it's, you know, people who are being peaceful. You know, there shouldn't be tanks going to their house, like in Waco. I think it's a little different when you have people burning down cities, with like we're seeing now. There's a little bit more nuance now, I guess.
Yes, and then can we talk? At some point, you sort of hit sort of another level of social media fame, at least in terms of when you decided to go from being a Bernie Sanders supporter to a Donald Trump supporter. Could you describe that conversion for you for the audience?
Yeah, I guess it was actually, I went and I met Noam Chomsky in Boston and I was a big Bernie supporter, and me and him were talking about free speech. And I went back to my hotel, went to a concert. I got home and Trump was speaking, and I put it on and I was watching it, and he was talking about Common Core, and he was talking about how, you know, we're blowing up schools in Iraq, but we can't build a school in Brooklyn, and we're rebuilding those, but we're not building here. And I was like, hey, this sounds, you know, exactly like what I believe. So I switched over. I didn't switch right away, but I started being more open to Trump, I guess. And this was late 2015, I think. And by the time the RNC and the DNC came along, I was already fully on board for Trump. I was like, the DNC is, you know, installing Hillary when Bernie clearly has the support. And then you have Trump, who's saying all these anti-intervention things, which is the main thing that I look for politically. So I switched over.
And it wasn't long after that I remember that you started receiving threats. Had you ever interacted with Antifa prior to that time frame?
Yeah, I mean, I would go to protests, and I knew a lot of people who were involved in Antifa. But back before Ferguson, it was all a little bit different. You know, they were protesting against war, and I went to an Antifa protest against Obama. I mean, I wasn't wearing Black Bloc or anything, but I went and I covered it, and it was a very different vibe than what we see post-Ferguson. I feel like everything changed after Ferguson and after the inauguration. It went from protesting the government to protesting your fellow people, kind of, you know, protesting Trump supporters or right-wing speakers who aren't politicians, don't have any power, and trying to shut down free speech, which was one of my core beliefs as somebody on the left, was, you know, you have the freedom to offend. Free speech is the most important thing there is. You can't protest war if you can't speak, you know. So, I felt like they left me more than I left them.
And can you describe, like, the first time I realized that this Antifa was going a different direction from just being disrupting, you know, the G20 or the World Trade Organization or both parties events or war events, to suddenly shifting to almost a Chinese Cultural Revolution style, going after people that were fellow believers at one time or may even have shared beliefs about certain matters of war, other politics, was when you have a young daughter, was when they started publicly threatening her on social media. Can you tell people what happened?
Yeah, so when they first started threatening my daughter, I ended up having to go to her school and tell them, you know, I just contacted the FBI. There's somebody who's threatening my child. Can you not let her play outside at recess? Keep an eye on her. And it was funny because the office at the school was like, oh, was it right-wing people? Was it people from Breitbart? Like, they were totally, like, oblivious to everything and immediately thought that I was, like, a leftist who was getting harassed by the right, when it was quite the opposite. And, you know, things escalated quite heavily since then. Nothing ended up happening with that. The woman who had made the threats lived in Texas, I believe. It ended up being fine, but now, yeah, things have escalated significantly.
Yeah, can you tell people, so you've been critical of the riots and the looting that's taking place and this new direction that Antifa and other groups are taking place in terms of attacking the local community rather than really attacking the police, though in the name of attacking the police. Could you describe what happened at your house this past about a week or so ago?
Yeah, so I had been really outspoken against the riots. I think that there's no point in destroying your own neighborhood. You're not hurting the man by burning down your local pharmacy where people go to get their medicine. You know, it's just stupid. And so I was being highly critical of it, and I made a couple jokes like, you know, clearly we need more oppression because people are able to burn down cities and loot targets without any repercussions. And I was just kind of joking about the fact that in an actually oppressed society, this would never fly. But people went absolutely bananas about it. The tweet took off. I started getting inundated with threats. And I get threats a lot, but not like this. I was getting hundreds of them. Like, and every time I looked at my inbox, they were just coming and coming. And then people started saying that they knew where I lived. And I told a lot of my friends that I was a little concerned and that the threat seemed more serious than normal. And everybody was like, oh, no, it's just keyboard warriors. It's fine, whatever. And so the day before they showed up at my house, somebody started tweeting out my address at people who were upset about my tweet. And Twitter did take it down relatively fast, but they let, you know, verified accounts tweet death threats at me, kept those tweets up for 18 hours. There was hundreds of them, hundreds. And so this person was going and, like, finding the most viral tweets that were complaining about me and then posting my address in the thread. And so I started getting, like, some pretty specific threats. And I hadn't slept in 2 days because I was covering the riots. Or it might have been 3 days. I don't even know. But I was talking to my boyfriend, and I was like, I need to go to bed. I'm so tired, but I'm so scared they're going to show up at my house because they've been posting my address, you know. All these people have been posting it all day. And he was like, no, it's fine. Just go to bed. And about 20 minutes later, my house is pitch black, right? All my lights were off. I was in bed. My daughter was in bed. I just hear this, like, loud explosion, and all the windows in my house are, like, bright lights. Like, it looks like there's floodlights in my house. It's so bright. And I just start hearing explosions coming from, like, all the sides of my house. So I got up, I grabbed a gun, and I went out towards my living room, and there's, like, a wall there. So I, like, ducked behind the wall, and I was trying to see, like, you know, if people were breaking in the windows or what was going on. And it was just like fireworks exploding everywhere. And people started banging on two of my windows. There's like a corner, and they were at like, they were like alternating between these two windows. So I'm on the phone at 911. They can't hear me over all the explosions and stuff. So I'm like screaming my address at them. And I'm like, my daughter's here. She's 9 years old. I've been getting threats all day. People are outside my house. It looks like the Purge. They're banging on my windows. There's fire everywhere. Cause I mean, they had these huge fireworks. It was not like cheap sparklers or something. Like, they were big mortars. And it went on for like 7 minutes, which felt much longer than it sounds. But my daughter ran out, and I'm pointing a gun at the window, and there's explosions everywhere. So she's in a panic, and I yelled at her to go to her bedroom and lay on the floor and lock the door and not to put her head up above the window. So she went in her room, and she called my dad on Skype, and was panicking, and I eventually hung up on 911 because they were telling me that they couldn't hear me. They didn't know where I was. They couldn't tell me how long it was going to take for police to get there because DC was rioting that night. So all the cops were down there. So I hung up and I called, Aurora's dad, who lives down the street. And I was like, I need you to bring guns and like get here fast. There's people outside the house. And he came and they took off, a few minutes before he got there. But I tried to film it a little, but I was also trying to call 911, and it was just, it was chaotic. I didn't expect them to really come to my house. I was worried, but like they were standing on children's toys in my front yard. Like doing that, knowing that there's a child in the house was like a whole different level.
Had you ever experienced anything like that before?
No. I mean, I've had keyboard warriors threaten me a million times. I've had my address posted before, but it wasn't, the threats weren't as specific and crazy and erratic as they were this time. And there were so many different groups of people that I pissed off, because the more they threatened me, the more I wanted to troll and be like, screw you guys, you know? So I was escalating what I was saying, and then their threats were escalating, and it just spiraled completely out of control. I mean, you never expect somebody to show up at your house over words on a screen. So,
can you describe, now, were you able to identify any of them?
No, the police told me that there's cameras all over the neighborhood, and my neighbors all came outside. Like, somebody from two streets down came, and they were like, it looked like a reactor blew up or something, because the fireworks that they found, like, the police looked in all the bushes and stuff, and they found all these mortars, like, on, like, big pieces of wood. So, neighbors came down, and they were like, it looked like a reactor exploded. Like, we thought something really bad happened. And then my other neighbors were outside, and they were like, what are you doing? And I was like, dude, it wasn't me. Like, did you see who it was? And they were like, no, we heard like a car peel off, but nobody saw. The police did say, though, that there's a lot of cameras in the neighborhood, so hopefully they can figure it out, maybe.
And in that context, it was a sign of an organized attack, in other words, by what happened and by what they've been able to see so far.
Oh, they spent so much money on this. Like, I love fireworks, and I don't even have I've never had fireworks like that high quality. Like, it was insane. I can't explain how, like, it lit up my entire house. My house looked like there were floodlights. They were huge. I don't know. My daughter was really shook up by it all, and sorry, I'm rambling, but they told me basically that because of the riots, there wasn't that much that they could do, and that I just needed to get to safety. And then they were like, well, call the police if you see anyone suspicious at all, like, just call. But they were like, you should, you know, leave your house and get somewhere safe. And that was all they could really do. It sucked.
And how did you explain it to your daughter?
I told her that some people were mad at me, so they wanted to prank me by waking me up. I didn't want to tell her that there's, you know, race riots down the street and that people were targeting us. So, yeah, I said that there was, you know, somebody was mad and they pranked me to wake me up. And then I sent her to her grandparents' house for the week while I move.
And how much did... I think for a lot of people that don't understand sort of guns as a means of safety, how much did having a gun make you feel safer in that context?
It made me feel a lot safer, but I don't recommend only having a revolver. My immediate thoughts were, it sounds like there's 10 people out there, and this revolver only shoots 6 bullets before I have to reload it. And so my thoughts were completely just, if it's men and women, shoot the men first, because the women will be less likely to hurt my daughter. And I was like, I can't even explain. I've never pulled out a gun with the intent to use it before. So it made me feel safer, but at the same time, I wished that I had something with more firepower in case it was like a mob and that they were going to come funneling through my window, you know?
Would you have plans to get better armed in the future?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And what else
that
have...
Off of my list.
And any particular sort of guns that you're looking at and training that you're looking at related to that?
I'm definitely getting an AR. And I'm going to get, you know, multiple magazines. And I'm going to be well-armed pretty soon here. I'm also moving to a red state. I don't really want to talk about where I'm moving too much, obviously, but moving to a very red state where people are expected to defend their property. It should be good. The new neighborhood has Trump flags everywhere, so I think that Antifa wouldn't be too welcome, or anyone else who wanted to target me.
Well, that has been one of the interesting things I was telling someone the other day, is that Antifa and almost all these rioters and looters are choosing Democratic cities, ideally even in Democratic states, but definitely heavily Democratic cities to engage in their criminal behavior. You don't see them going to rural Alabama and trying to stir up trouble there that often. Were you surprised at how ultimately a place like D.C. or a place like L.A. or a place like San Francisco or a place like New York is no longer safe for someone just because of their political beliefs?
Yeah, it's terrifying. I mean, I took my dog to the vet today and somebody took pictures of me when I said my name. You know, it's creepy being here. And you've been to my house. I don't live in the city. I live on the outskirts. If people are coming out here, that's insane. And the realtors that I talked to were all like, everybody's fleeing the city. There's no houses. Like, it took a while to find something because everybody is getting out. Everybody's like, it's not safe. And they said that they have waiting lists of like 30 to 40 people in these tiny towns that normally are, you know, places sit on the market for a year. So I don't know.
Do you think the fact that it was publicly known that you were armed might have actually helped defend you in that context, that they were willing to try to create a terroristic environment but not willing to broach the door?
Yeah, and I mean, I made it very clear that I was armed. I definitely shouted that I was prepared to, you know, stack bodies. But I think that it did help, for sure. And they could probably see me. I mean, my house was bright, like, and I was pointing it at the window, and I was like, do it, I dare you, like, it was, I don't know. I'm glad that I had it, even though it was just a tiny revolver.
Right. It was better than, you know, being like that guy holding a machete who ended up getting the daylights kicked out of him.
That was going through my head, too. I was like, oh, my God, my daughter's here. They're like, I'm going to go to reload this and they're going to kill me. And then they're going to find her.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. Did you ever imagine something like this could have happened 4 years ago, 5 years ago?
No. Like, the fact that it's controversial to support the president and to support order is insane. Like, it's completely popular and socially acceptable to call for the White House to be burned down. But for me to say that the riots need to stop is, like, shocking to people. How did we get to this? It's insane.
And how have some of your, you have a lot of friends and followers that are on the left. How are they handling, I mean, how many of them are recognizing this is going nuts? I mean, there's people like Tim Pool and other people who have said this is insane from day one. I have other friends on the left that, and my own son and daughter seem to think it's cool at times. In terms of Black Lives Matter in that aspect, not the rioting and the looting. So I'm seeing a wide disparity of responses. What are you seeing in the people that follow you, particularly those that are on the left? How many of them are waking up to this is nuts? And how many of them are, no, let's, you know, more, more, more?
I mean, a lot of people I've known for years have blocked me because I was speaking out against it. My daughter's dad and I were fighting the whole week before this happened. He was supportive of the riots, and I was like, how? You are insane. Like, we live here. Places that you go are going to burn down. He obviously changed his mind after he came to my house and found all the stuff that they left behind outside. But, yeah, it's been mixed. There's a lot of my friends who are left who are like, you're right, this is nuts. But you need to, like, they're also like, you need to chill out. Like, shouldn't be saying these really intense things. It's mixed. I don't know.
And what was the reaction after they attacked your house?
I mean, Ezra called me the next day from Rebel Media, and he's a saint. And I was frazzled, and I was sitting outside. I hadn't slept in so long, and I was just, you know, drinking at 6 o'clock in the morning because I was losing my mind. And he called, and he was like, let me start a GoFundMe. And I was like, no, it's fine. And he was like, at least it'll help you with moving costs or whatever. So I figured that maybe it would, you know, be enough to cover like a couple nights of Airbnb, and it ended up raising an extreme amount of money, which has been extremely helpful for moving and for shipping my daughter off to her grandparents, because she didn't want to sleep here ever again. But yeah, people have been really supportive, even on the left. There's some reporters who are trying to dig around and prove that it didn't happen. But I mean, they can come talk to my neighbors. So they're going to look pretty foolish if they try and go that route.
Have you been surprised at some of the media's reaction at convincing, like, I mean, even the New York Times was talking about no real evidence of Antifa's involvement. I mean, Antifa is bragging about it in every context they possibly can, including Mark Bray, who's sort of their main apologist, the professor originally from Dartmouth. I think now he's at Rutgers. Have you been surprised at some of the reaction? Because a lot of people in the press know of your reputation for sincerity and authenticity. This would not be something you would make up. Are you surprised? I've been surprised at the degree of insanity.
Yeah, I've been extremely surprised. And, you know, there's a lot of reporters who write about Antifa all the time favorably who are now suddenly like, oh, no, that's not a thing. And it's like, what? Of course it's a thing. And I've seen you hanging out with them. Like, what are you talking about? They're definitely running cover. There's a lot of reporters running cover for Antifa right now, and it's kind of gross.
So is the GoFundMe over at this stage?
Yeah, it's pretty much. I'm good.
Okay. So if people want to follow you, where can they follow you on both the District Herald site and the other sites? Could you give those out for folks?
So I write for Gateway Pundit, and I have my own website that I started recently. That's District Herald, and I'm on Twitter at Cassandra Rules.
Thanks for being with us, Cassandra. Sorry you went through the insanity, but hopefully the new state will be a prettier state for all purposes.
It will. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Thanks. We'll be back right after the break to take some of your calls and to go into some more of the insanity and its historical origins and roots, ideologically and in the past.
You are about to embark on a great debate. And one for all.
America first.
Welcome back to American Countdown. We continue to encourage you to support our sponsor, InfoWarsStore.com, where a wide range of sales and products are currently on sale. You can find things like ChillForce that can help you de-stress. It has products in it that, as we've gone through on this show, include things that both WebMD and other scientific and medical literature publications have independently confirmed have been established remedies, organic natural remedies, to deal with issues related to stress and anxiety, particularly helpful and applicable in this time and age. So you can go to InfoWarsStore.com and get things like Chill Force, get things like Brain Force that just help you wake up and focus. I made the mistake once of taking too many of them and ended up being alert for about 24 hours straight. So I recommend you use the appropriate dosage. But it has a wide range of products. Knockout, which just helps you go to sleep. Melatonin helps you go to sleep naturally, another natural product, and doesn't have some of the hangover and side effects that other products can. But there's also coffee. There's also T-shirts and hats. There's also a wide range of other products, books, literature, DVDs, whatever it is that you want to get that is useful for you. In the process, you can become healthier, wealthier, and wiser. Healthier because you're able to get products that support your physical health and mental well-being. wealthier because you can get them right now 60% off across the board. And thus you get them at a deep discount, not only off its product, but a deeper discount off of what the market alternative would offer. And Wiser, because you're able to support independent media, the most significant, substantial, independent, non-corporate, non-sugar daddy media anywhere in the modern world that brings you independent information where you get to decide what news you choose to believe in and what views you choose to have. You, the audience, get to be the determiner of the content, not some corporation or billionaire. So continue to support our sponsor and make possible shows like this on a continuous basis. Going back to the Epoch Times article entitled "The Nature of Chaos and Anarchy as Tools of Communist Subversion or Radical Subversion of Any Kind," it notes in the article, and it references a wide range of historical sources, the ideological and intellectual literature of the left and the radical left itself, and it notes that this is effectively what unites the sort of neo-Marxist radical perspective in terms of active politics, whether it's Che Guevara's guerrilla tactics or Saul Alinsky's rules for organizers, is to create step-by-step the gradual destruction of traditional culture and moral values through its various social movements, to undermine, to attack, to assault, to destroy, to wreck, to basically light up with arson the traditional values and mores that govern and guide a society. It is that lack of respect for the past that means it is ruleless moving forward. And it's what leads to things like the French Revolution's Reign of Terror. It's what leads to leveraging the mob and street violence in 1920s, 1930s, 1940s Europe that led to the rise of both communism and fascism. Fascists also borrowed the mob logic. The fascists also borrowed the street violence technique to achieve, attain, and sustain power. And in that same capacity, it led to the disasters of the Chinese Cultural Revolution. But there were other illustrations and examples of that as well. For example, in Russia, a young boy ratted out his own father, Pavlik Morozov. In fact, we'll show in the background video clip 36. They actually built monuments to him. They wrote songs to him. Stalin made him a national hero. And the way Stalin made him a national hero was because he got his own father sent to Siberia, sent to the Gulag. That is the nature of the ideology of destroying everything in the past, no respect for the individual, no respect for the human being, only a recognition for groups, only a recognition and the easy engagement of blood libels, that something about your status, something about your ancestors means that you somehow are bad, in the same way we see language like white privilege being utilized. That sounds a lot like the blood libel long used against people of the Jewish faith. And it led to dangerous pogroms and ultimately the Holocaust, one of the most horrific events in human history. So that mindset, that mentality of collectivist recognition and no individualized acknowledgement, seeing a person's only utility is to the state or to the system or to the cause, rather than as an individual human being with their own conscience, with their own mind. Indeed, long ago when they were worried about the domination of the Catholic Church during the Inquisition, one of the great reformers and revolutionaries, a true revolutionary rooted in the ideals of humanity, said that there's two great schools of learning that the state and the church can never close. Those are the archives of nature and the rights of man. That if we listen to our conscience and use our mental capacity to see the world around us, we can divine the truth ourselves. God speaks to us directly and indirectly, and we don't need either a church or a state to prevent or preclude us or determine that for us. And yet that is precisely what the state obsesses over. It must radically eliminate religion, radically eliminate business, radically eliminate the individual's existence. Turn on your friend, turn on your family member, turn on your neighbor. That's why we're seeing real live struggle sessions take place on our streets where they're demanding police, sheriffs, cops, mayors, politicians bow before them, get on their knees in front of them. Indeed, that's the mindset, the mentality of the struggle session where they put the sign around them and walked them through the streets to humiliate them further. Let's take a look at another one of the clips from that Chinese Cultural Revolution, clip number 31.
In 1966, I was in the middle school when the Cultural Revolution started.
The biggest nation on earth, China, is in turmoil. Is China's aging leader, Mao Zedong, losing control? Has Mao gone mad, driven perhaps to megalomania by the hysterical adulation of the teenage Red Guard?
Of course, I joined. It's glorious to join here. I was totally pour my energy, even my life, into it to support whatever Mao asked me to do.
Mao had decided to mobilize the young people as the driving force of a vast campaign to purify the Communist Party. There was to be a new revolution, a cultural revolution, a revolution in people's thinking.
We went to Beijing. Mao received us after we arrived. We walk out in the middle of night because in the morning we are going to walk through Tiananmen Square to see our great leader. It was exciting. We thought he was a god.
Inspired by Mao, the Red Guards went wild in their enthusiasm to keep the revolution alive. They worship Mao as their leader and follow his instructions without question. They consider long hair and Western-style clothes uncommunist.
Teachers were the target of the political campaign. Mao taught us they have to receive the re-education by the worker and peasant. My female teacher, I love. She liked to wear beautiful clothes. She cared for appearance. There was a criminal accusation. One boy went to her bedroom and lit so many people, she went there to cut her hair. I went there too late. The hair has been cut already. He was humiliated. I couldn't help. I couldn't help. I couldn't rescue her. Shame on me. Shame on me.
After reports of riotings, beatings up, and even murder, the Red Guards seem to have gone too far. Their leaders have told them to cool off and go and help with the harvest.
The end of 1967, I began to kind of reflection, and I found that Mao was not in control of the Cultural Revolution. And we lucky live in the southern China. There is a choice to escape to Hong Kong. I took this risk and begin to my free life. I studied sociology and later on went to UC Berkeley for political science. In America, I settled with my family, children, grandchildren, and also my career, my business. I'm 70 now. Now is the Rega generation, 70. I hope that they reflect, they regret, they re-exam. What should we prevent this kind of human tragedy happen again?
Indeed, there's a film about an American who actually went to the Chinese Revolution, went to China before the revolution was successful, originally was going to work with the State Department, someone who grew up in the radical left of his own kind, who believed in the Mao cause. He believed in it so much that even when he was quickly arrested and put in solitary imprisonment for 6 years, he went back and joined the cause again, getting to even a high-ranking position and even participating in the beginning stages of the Cultural Revolution. Then he would witness its complete horrors as friends and family members were imprisoned and beaten and treated terribly for no reason at all, even though he was a true believer to that day. We'll show you a trailer for that film that you can see that's available. It's called The Revolutionary, where he goes into detail about the dangers of giving any one man any such great power as Mao was given, whether it's a billionaire like Bill Gates or George Soros or a communist leader like Mao or Stalin, or a Nazi like or fascist like Hitler or Mussolini, the same outcomes get repeated again and again when we give one person too much power to experiment with society and government on the rest of us like the radical left wants to do. They want to do continuous experiments, the same way the white lab coat types have used this as a Milgram experiment in the pandemic lockdown context. That is where the great danger lies. Not only the ideology of radical terror, not only the ideology of mob violence, not only the ideology of disrespecting the past and traditions, but giving too much power to any set one cause or one individual. Here's the clip from the trailer from the film. We'll show clip number 34.
He was a great hero and a great criminal, all rolled up into one. He was a genius whose genius got completely out of control.
You were leaving America behind you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there not pause for thought about that?
Not a bit. Not at the time. I met Mao for the first time on the day I arrived in Yan'an. I walked in the door, and there he was. And I thought, it's like a picture right out of history. You have accepted a mission from U.S. imperialism to sabotage the Chinese Revolution. Every day is miserable because you're alone, but you're not really alone, because every day you're sitting there with your own potential madness sitting across from you, watching you, and you know it's either you or him.
And you were well paid?
Well, in the local terms, I was paid better than Mao.
What did they want to hear from you?
Well, you know, it was a romantically built-up figure, this American who spoke fluent Chinese, who was from the generation of Yan'an, but unlike most of that generation, actively supported the Cultural Revolution. A revolution is not like inviting guests to dinner. It can't be that civilized, that courteous, that gracious, that gentle.
And it wasn't.
It wasn't.
That phrase, that revolution is not like a dinner party, it can't be that gentle, actually comes from Mao himself. It was part of the justification and rationalization to unleash a bunch of kids, called them the Red Guards. They put the red stashes on them, on their arms, that led them to go after their parents, led them to go after their teachers, led them to go after their friends and their families. The denunciations were so horrifying, they've stayed in the memory for decades later. In China, they don't talk about it much. Not those who went through it, not the school teachers, and definitely not the government. Much of its history is being lost as that generation passes on. However, it has stayed in the minds of various filmmakers, whether The Last Emperor or The Red Violin or Farewell My Concubine have all portrayed scenes that relate to the time of the Cultural Revolution and its horrifying effects on the psyche of a nation. Let's take a look at one of those clips, clip number 30.
She 西疯子，
谁？说清楚！
他是只管唱戏啊！啊，他们不管台下坐的什么人，什么阶级，他都卖力的唱，他玩命的唱，
避重就轻。
没有没有，你不老实！
太小了，不投降，就叫他灭亡！
抗日战争刚刚开始，他就给日本侵略者唱堂会，他就当了汉奸。
给国民党伤兵唱戏，给北平学员的反动头子唱戏，给资本家唱，给地主老财唱，给太太小姐唱，给地痞流氓唱，给宪兵警察唱，他给大西坝袁世清唱。
大西
坝袁世清唱。
大
西坝袁
世清
唱。
大西坝袁世清
唱。他抽大烟，他抽起大烟来没命，不知抽光了多少人劳动人民的血和汗。
见
识什么见？
他为了讨好大西坝袁世清，你有没有？他跟袁世清，他当了。
小龙，
他当了。你有没有？你当。
王三爷，牛鬼上身。
你们都骗我，都骗我。
解放查子烟火，解放断臂腿软，断小龙你天良丧尽，狼心狗肺，扣上一张人皮了。自打你贴上这个女人，我就知道完了，什么都完了。你当今日小人作乱，祸从天降，不是，不对，是咱们自个儿一步一步一步步走到这步田地来的报应。我早就不是东西了，连这楚霸王都跪下来求饶了，那这惊喜他能不亡吗？能不亡吗？报应，老爷，
老爷，
我结巴，就是他，他是什么人？我来告诉你们，他是什么人？臭婊子，淫妇，他是花满楼的头牌妓女潘金莲。揍他，去揍他，揍他呀！
范小龙，他是不是妓女？
是不是？说，
是。你爱他吗？
艾布莱，
不，不爱，不爱他，
真的不爱，
真的不爱，真的，我不真的不爱他，我跟他划清界限。
肮脏的夜店快开门！肮脏的夜店快
出去！我从此跟他划清界限了。我跟他划清界限了，我跟他划清界限了。
That was from Farewell, My Concubine. Other films like The Last Emperor and Red Violin have comparable scenes within them. The Taiwanese, for a long time, have had its own film industry criticizing and exposing various Chinese abuses. But you won't find many of those films from the Chinese propaganda era, of course, nor did they keep films of reminding the world about what they did during that insane time. Take a look at photo image number 16, and you see just one of the images from that time period where the young kids are around screaming and yelling while a older man has this placard over his head. Often, as you saw from the film, they would often stick dunce caps on people's head. These were often elders, leaders, seniors, teachers, parents, who were the ones betrayed by their own children or their own students. Now compare it to image number 14, where we have white protesters who are supposed to bow down and wash the feet of other people in the name of their public shame and humiliation, of denunciating their own so-called white privilege. If we take a look at the image from number 19, we saw Democrats joined in all of this today, putting on a various form of African scarves and getting down on one knee in the same tradition as if they're all Colin Kaepernick, but they are taking a submissive posture to this so-called revolutionary spirit. Of course, Nancy Pelosi had to be lifted up because she couldn't get up on her own 2 feet after she went down. No surprise there. Meanwhile, what they were doing were things like image number 7, where here they went and actually defaced in one part of the world, the one part of the country, the statue of Gandhi. That didn't stop them, as they also went about doing it to various statues all across the country. Indeed, they even did it to the 54th Regiment, Massachusetts Regiment, during the Civil War, which was a black regiment. So they actually went and defaced a statute and a memorial honoring black soldiers fighting to end slavery. That gives you an idea of the kind of mindset and mentality that was sweeping the country, the kind of insanity that took over and consumed the country this past weekend. It has led to a sort of mindset and a mentality that would devour the past in the same way we saw them pulling down the statutes and during the Chinese Cultural Revolution, emptying their great monasteries and destroying them and wrecking them. The monasteries you see across China today, outside of Hong Kong, are mostly rebuilt. They're not the ones that were there centuries before, that had lasted for centuries and couldn't withstand the 10 years of the insanity of the Chinese Cultural Revolution, where Mao was substituted for where a Buddha statue once stood. That attack on religion, that attack on antiquity, that attack on tradition, that attack on history, that attack on their own past led people in Bristol in the United Kingdom to physically tear down statues and throw them into the river because they didn't like the political association of something about that statue from somewhere in the past. Rather than recognizing and dealing with history, not all statues have to honor someone. You can just recognize that's our past, that's our history. Have to be something that you celebrate every aspect or every attribute of. But that is the mindset and the mentality. Attack statutes, attack memorials, attack history, even if it's Gandhi and even if it's a regiment of black soldiers that it's honoring. That's the mentality that has consumed. That's the insanity that has waved across the country. And it should be no surprise that it is rooted in an ideology that we find in the French Revolution's Reign of Terror, that we find in the street violence of the communists and the fascists from the 20s, 30s, and 40s that we find in the Chinese Cultural Revolution expressed in its most extreme and insane forms. In that same context, if we are to resist it, if we are to push back against it, We must understand our history and not be like some of these sheriffs that are laying flat prostrate in front of the people that ask them, not be the National Guard or FBI soldiers who feel obligated, whether it's National Guard or soldiers or FBI members who feel the obligation to kneel in front of someone else in submission or in subservience, people renouncing their own status and their own so-called white privilege, having to culturally conform or risking their employment, risking their social status. Indeed, you had an LA Galaxy football player get dismissed from his team because of his wife's comments on social media. You saw Drew Brees go through a true live struggle session like the one you saw portrayed in The Last Concubine, or Farewell, My Concubine, also portrayed in movies like The Last Emperor, where they're having to denounce things and even make up crazier and loonier things to be able to satiate the thirst of the young mob. Well, in the same context, you had Drew Brees say that he just stands for the flag, for the national anthem, because his grandfathers helped free the world from Nazis and fascists, and he feels that he needs to honor them. That, of course, led some of his teammates and other players in the NFL who were back on that virtue signaling kick. Many of these players have never shown up in the history of civil rights movement doing anything of consequence or significance. They're usually like LeBron James, wanting to virtue signal to the world to sell more sneakers. While people like LeBron James are selling sneakers made by child labor, they feel the necessity to condemn all of America that doesn't subserve the BLM agenda. That's why the BLM agenda is, in that respect, kind of cheap. So when we come back, we'll talk about how Black Lives Matter is basically a cheap knockoff of the Black Panther Party. What went wrong in the Black Panther Party? How it previewed what would go wrong with the Black Lives Matter movement? Not only the degree to which they borrow from these reign of terror mob mindset, eliminate the past histories, but other core deficiencies that we will expose. BLM, or Black Lives Matter, is really sort of a cheap knockoff of the Black Panthers Party, but shares some of the same defects, as well as some of the same reasons for fame and notoriety and momentary transitory success in the civil rights movement. For example, BLM and Black Panther Party both depended on money from millionaires and media celebrity to achieve and attain their status and stature in the first instance at a nationwide level. They both also shared other core defects. Both the Black Panther Party and the Black Lives Movement Black Lives Matter movement are not rooted in the black church, not rooted in the black business community, and not rooted in long-standing black experienced civil rights leaders, both led by younger members whose lack of connection to those three institutions and individuals from those institutions disserve their ability to make meaningful change. They also shared a lack of respect for the past or tradition or history, wanted the same radical, insurrectionary, revolutionary change that was too unrooted to be able to achieve and attain that change. People like X, people like Martin Luther King, rooted their civil rights movement in our constitutional history, in our ideas of freedom, and in the religious and business communities of the African-American community in America. That is why they're able to achieve such meaningful success. Now, their assassinations helped create the opening for the Black Panther Party of the late 1960s. And the one Black Panther member who could have actually created a Martin Luther King, Malcolm X type redefinition of the Black Panther Party, Fred Hampton, was assassinated by the Chicago police in 1969. They would at least implicitly admit that by paying millions of dollars to his family years later, though they and the FBI hid the truth from the public and the press at the time. It was, in fact, what was unique about Fred Hampton was he was rooted in the black church. He was rooted in the black civil rights community. He had connections to black business, and he was trying to create a cross-racial coalition. His mantra was, everyone's a revolutionary. You're a revolutionary. I'm a revolutionary. And in fact, he reached out to Latino groups and to Appalachian groups to help form organizing efforts in Chicago. There's famous meetings where he and people from the Appalachian part of the country that had settled in Chicago, later featured in various films and other aspects of Chicago culture and political culture, also popular in Detroit because many people from southern Ohio, southern Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, my home state, had moved up there for the auto manufacturing jobs that existed after World War II, for the same reason that many African Americans had moved there as well. But the removal of Fred Hampton removed any opportunity for the Black Panther Party to become something like the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King or Malcolm X. Their lack of connection to the Black church, their lack of connection to the Black business community, their lack of connection to elder civil rights members made them almost destined to fail. They also made them easy to suffer three groups of infiltrators. Black Panther Party easily suffered from informers from the FBI. The head of security for Fred Hampton was in fact an undercover informant for the FBI who had been caught committing a wide range of crimes. But also the Black Panther Party was vulnerable to two other forms of infiltrators that did severe damage to its long-term institutional hopes to make meaningful substantive change. The first were neo-Marxists. Because the Black Panther Party wasn't rooted in the church, wasn't rooted in the business community, wasn't rooted in senior civil rights leaders, did not respect the past or tradition or appeal to the constitutional history or the Thomas Paine ideas that helped animate American history or the shared religious beliefs of many Americans, because it walked away from that and even looked down upon it, it made it easy for Marxist and actual communists to infiltrate. Indeed, Eldridge Cleaver, the Black Panther Party spokesperson, would flee to Algeria because it was a communist country where the North Vietnamese would give them their embassy to operate the International Black Panther Party, and they would become publicly aligned with communist causes around the world. The third group that was was also able to easily infiltrate the Black Panther Party were gangs. In fact, the Black Panthers were in many cities across the country initially formed by gangs who simply took a new name. Indeed, for example, the Slauson gang, which became the most dominant in South Central Los Angeles, several of its members just rebranded as the Black Panthers, and later they would rebrand as the Crips. You should look up the acronym for the Crips. It actually sounds like a Black Panther kind of name, a committee for revolutionary change and that kind of thing. All of the gangs decided to rebrand as a political revolutionary group, like the Young Lords of Chicago, who was a Latino-based gang that became this, because it was more effective to engage in things like extortion and embezzlement and other kinds of criminal behavior, enforcement of criminal behavior, if, in fact, you relabeled yourself a political movement, a revolutionary movement, an insurrectionary movement. And so it was always a serious and severe problem for the Black Panthers that while they had several sincere members, they were easily infiltrated by insincere members, whether informers really working for the government trying to undermine it. Indeed, COINTELPRO, the organization led by Mark Felt and directed by J. Edgar Hoover, would have over 200 plus operations directed at the Black Panthers. But they had something to go on because the Black Panthers were in fact being infiltrated by Marxist and communists, and in fact were being infiltrated by gang members and criminals. Indeed, the very nature of the Black Panther Party made that possible. The Black Panther Party originally started simply as a self-defense group who used the loose gun laws, the then Second Amendment conforming gun laws of California, to simply defend their community from police brutality or abuse. They would follow where cops would go in Oakland, and they would simply be behind them, not interfere in any way with the arrest, but show up with their black leather coats and berets and their guns, usually various forms of serious weaponry, to make sure the police did not engage in police abuse. But who is going to be a critical benefactor of the police stepping back, what's now called the Ferguson effect, by people like Professor Heather McDonald, because of the effect of police no longer policing certain communities or certain areas because they fear the blowback from something going wrong and then becoming the next Zimmerman or the next officer like the one who was targeted in the Michael Brown case, who did nothing wrong and had no controversial history prior to that, but whose life was completely ruined and career completely crushed because of the press coverage concerning it. Well, it's going to be the criminals, because if the police less, then the criminals are going to profit and gain. That is why gangs always have had a comfortable relationship with the Black Panther Party type groups. So it was natural for them to want to infiltrate such groups because they were providing effectively a racket to politically protect criminal behavior from police investigation, interrogation, and arrest and prosecution. But that was only the beginning of the problems for the Black Panther Party. The problems would accumulate as the Black Panthers ultimately got involved in embezzlement, got involved in extortion, got involved in murder, and other criminal behaviors, much of which would be suppressed by the institutional press. Because big money and big media loved the Black Panthers, in part because they were the revolutionary chic, in part because it was a legitimate expression of African-American concern, and in part because it fit their own liberal racist stereotypes about African-Americans, as we'll show you from an African-American author who wrote about the Black Panther Party in a book called The Shadow of a Panther here in just a little bit. The context for the Black Panthers in general did grow out of legitimate concerns. The original gangs of South Central L.A., like many other black gangs across the country, actually started as self-defense systems of networks of people to defend against racist white activities, including violence against them by local neighborhoods. Not only that, this was all fed by the Great Migration. During World War II, during the 1940s, many African Americans fled the South, in part because of the brutality and oppression of the South towards black Americans, but also because of the manufacturing jobs now being offered in wartime factories and in the post-World War II boom. However, it was the destruction of those same manufacturing jobs that started in the urban centers in the 1960s and then would then spread across the country in the following decades, particularly in the 1990s and 2000s, thanks to the WTO presence of China, gifted to them by both Presidents Clinton and Bush, the net effect of which was to lead to a loss of employment disproportionately impacting the African-American community. Racial discrimination, banking discrimination, housing discrimination, employment discrimination, everyday police discrimination, all added to the aggravated effect of what was happening in the African-American community. In 1960, African-American employment was less than white unemployment. That would change quickly as the manufacturing jobs fled. In that context and flowed in, also a liberal professional class that wanted to leverage African-American populations in major cities to destroy their working-class opponents in the ethnic political machines that governed across the urban Midwest and West Coast. Those urban political machines are well described in a book about the Baltimore white working class from the 1950s to the late 1960s, and how the professional class used civil rights concerns to try to destroy the integrity of working-class ethnic neighborhoods, working-class ethnic jobs, working-class ethnic communities, and working-class ethnic populations. So while there were legitimate concerns over racial discrimination in a wide range of contexts, they were often being leveraged for the benefit of a liberal professional class who wanted to undermine the political power of the local working class. And that led to even more confrontation and conflict. Ultimately, what was born out of all of that was a group of gangs that had developed their own institutional influence that when they no longer needed to defend their community against outsiders, grew to engage in criminal behavior within their community, particularly as jobs fled those communities. Increasingly, it was the only opportunity. That was furthered, of course, by the drug trade, where deliberate decisions were made, where the FBI let the mob know if the mob did not engage in drug dealing outside of the African-American community, then they would not be looked at from a federal prosecutorial perspective. That led to the flooding of the African-American community from New York and Harlem to North Vegas and L.A. Of products like heroin, particularly during the Vietnam War era, occurred. Indeed, if you track our wars, you'll also track the degrees of heroin addicts frequently across the country going back to the 1920s. You can review that in books about heroin and the Cold War and its relationship over time. That context worsened issues in the African-American community where often the only economic opportunity was illicit criminality for which a gang culture had already built up originally to defend the community now was used as a means to enrich themselves at the expense of the community. That trend would continue all the way to Freeway Ricky, in the 1980s, who would be used by Nicaraguan CIA contacts and affiliated people to distribute crack cocaine in Los Angeles and Oakland for the purposes of enriching the war against the Contras war against the Sandinistas in Central America, which also led to dealing with guns and money with Iran as well. So in that context flew the power and the potency of the Black Panthers. Here's a bit of a history of the Black Panthers. Let's take a look at clip number 24.
Were you ever shocked by what you learned?
Very shocked. I mean, I did not go into writing this book thinking I was going to uncover the shocking things I uncovered.
No. Name a couple.
Some of the murders.
Who was murdered?
The people like Fred Bennett, who was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to why he was murdered. Some people say that the Panthers thought he was an informant and murdered him. Other people say that he got the wife of a major leader in the party pregnant and was murdered as a result of that.
Where was he murdered?
He was murdered in the Santa Cruz Mountains, outside of Santa Cruz, California.
When?
This was about in 1971, if I remember correctly, the beginning of 71.
Have they ever caught the person that...
No, they didn't. I mean, there was a person who was working with, as an undercover agent, who helped dispose of the body. He's not the person who actually planned the murder and engaged in the murder. But while he was working undercover in the Black Panther Party, in order that he'd not be found out as an undercover agent, he did go along with helping to dispose the body.
What else shocked you?
Another murder that shocked me that there's a lot of speculation on is the murder of Betty Van Patter. Now, there's a lot of murkiness surrounding
Betty
Van Patter.
Woman,
yeah, who became a bookkeeper for a little while for the Black Panther Party. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to whether or not the party killed her, and the people that I talked to, there's convincing evidence that she was killed by the party, but there's a lot of controversy surrounding that, largely to do with the fact that Betty Van Patter is white, and there's a lot of people who are angry that murder is focused on as a possible Black Panther murder, because they say, well, you know, why focus on this white person who the Panther Party is being accused of murdering, and no, not focus on all the blacks who were accused of the Panther Party was accused of murdering. So I can kind of understand that, but at the same time, I think that the number of innocent people, like a woman like Betty Van Patter, or even Fred Bennett, or anybody who was killed by the party or accused of being killed by the party, I think I think that's something that stands out in my mind as something that the party should is something that shows the party should not be seen purely as a revolutionary do-good organization. And I just think that those two murders and some other murders, murders that I didn't even uncover that rumors about murders, and those are the types of things that the rumors as well as the hard evidence is so strong that the party should not be seen is purely the revolutionary vanguard that a lot of people on the left and in the liberal community want to see it as.
Gangsta rap.
I think gangsta rap very much grows out of the image of the Black Panther Party created for young black men. This image of defiant posturing that stands out in particular with Huey Newton sitting on the throne, gun in one hand and spear in the other. And also with what Eldridge Cleaver was doing. Eldridge Cleaver engaged.
Who was he?
Eldridge Cleaver was for a time, he was basically the leader of the Black Panther Party while Huey Newton was in jail. He was the Minister of Information, and he, in about 1968, when Huey Newton was sitting in jail waiting to go on trial for the murder of an Oakland police officer, Cleaver, for the most part, became the mouthpiece for the party, and also Bobby Seale. But Cleaver was a person whose initial fame came from writing a book called Soul on Ice. Soul on Ice was a book that was probably the first really outrageous book about young black men who were seen as what I would say are the noble savage image that I think young black men still suffer from. Cleaver talked about raping women. He said, well, at first he raped a black woman and then he crossed the tracks, so to speak, and started raping white women. He basically, in the book, kind of gave a lot of rationales for why a young black man in a poor community can turn into a criminal. And he was basically, and you had a lot of critics who were fascinated with what he said because he could write very well. I mean, the things he was saying were very disturbing and outrageous. And he started making speeches after he became a Black Panther that would basically condone killing judges and things if you go to court and the verdict didn't come out the way you want it.
Didn't the conservatives endorse him a few years ago?
Well, after he came back, he fled to Algeria. He fled to Algeria and came back to the United States. He was in Algeria and France for a while, and he came back to the United States in 1975. And he professed that he was a new person. He renounced his Black Panther days. He renounced his radical philosophy altogether. And he became part of Reverend Sun Myung-moon's church. He became a conservative for a while. So yeah, the conservatives supported him. Now, I didn't research, engage in a lot of research of all that Eldridge Cleaver engaged in after he came back in 1975 up to like say today. But yeah, he did become a conservative for a while. And he's been involved in some minor criminal activity, in the last few years as well.
Did you talk to him?
No, I didn't talk to him. The reason I didn't talk to him is because of what I said a little bit earlier. I wanted to look at Newton and contrast Newton with the rank people who are in the rank and file, because I think that a lot of I did want to talk to Seal and couldn't get to Seal, but I think that one of the reasons is because I did want to concentrate on what the rank and file members of the party did, and the other reason was because I thought that the notion that the people who were the leaders of the party were going to be very candid about the party was something that I didn't agree with. I thought that all people who are in the positions of prominence for the most part, or I should say most people who are in the positions of prominence for the most part, have an interest in protecting their image. So I felt in writing the book, I wanted to talk to the people who were the foot soldiers of the party, because it became quite clear to me after beginning my research that there was an entire side of the story about the Black Panther Party, the rank and file members and what they went through, that was the gist of what the party was all about. What you saw with Huey Newton, what you saw with Bobby Seale, what you saw with Eldridge Cleaver was a very small part of what the Black Panther phenomenon was all about. If they were all public relations people, they were not the foot soldiers.
You make some connections in the back of the book. Former L.A. gang member Cody Scott, mm-hmm. who earned the moniker Monster Cody mm-hmm. from L.A. police after he brutally beat a man to death, describes in his memoir, Monster, the autobiography of an L.A. gang member, mm-hmm. the senseless murders of other blacks, mm-hmm. which he also engaged in as a member of L.A.'s eight Crips.
Right.
Right. But you go on, though, you say white journalist William Broyles, I think mm-hmm. he's former editor of Newsweek, who facilitated the publication of Scott's book, is analogous to journalist Bob Scheer, who mm-hmm. in 1966 was a facilitator of Eldridge Cleaver's career. Mm-hmm. Do you give the Broyles Scheer team good marks or bad marks for facilitating the careers of these two men?
I give them bad marks, because I think there's a real element in this society. I hate to use labels, but I would say leftist liberal element in American society that has this notion that that true blacks are blacks who are basically kind of I'd just be blunt about it, uncivilized, and that they think of people like Monster Cody, they think of people like the Eldridge Cleaver from Soul on Ice as being the true black people, and that when these people write books about how they engage in their pathological behavior, they really think they're seeing the true black person, and they raw and unfiltered. So I think that Bob Scheer very, very much played into that image. Now, I can't speak for the Bob Scheer who exists today, but Bob Scheer from that era very much played into that, because it was a very popular thing to play into, this notion of, okay, my God, I mean, what is blackness all about? And the idea, well, blackness is all about this pathology that we in white America are largely responsible for. So I think that this thing that Eldridge Cleaver promoted in his book Soul on Ice and was kind of brought to the surface by a Bob Scheer is carried over into the leftist liberal philosophy about, black people in general. And William Broyles picked it up and brought it on in with Monster Cody, and this whole idea of, okay, what is this monster that we see in South Central L.A.? I mean, what is he all about? Let's examine his behavior. And it carries over into movies like Menace to Society, this idea of the blacks not being responsible, the blacks at the bottom having no real responsibility for where they are, society having created this monster, and let's examine this monster and try to figure out what makes this monster tick. So that's what I'm referring to when I make the...
That same sort of decimation of black identity, where someone becomes defined by the color of their skin, not the content of their character, something that infects white liberal and white left interpretation of African-American culture and society and civilization, goes way back. It helped idolize a particular image of the black man, someone dangerous, someone threatening, someone animalistic, someone passionate. BLM has followed the same kind of pattern, often elevating the worst cases involving the individuals with the worst rap sheets to try to actually feed to the divisiveness of the reaction to the individuals by both playing into the left's interpretation of black men as some sort of dangerous, jungle-like, scary creature who they should feel bad for and need to depend upon them to bring them into the modern age. In other words, the leftist, the ideas behind imperialist colonialism is in fact an idea that infects the modern left, the contemporary liberal, not in fact the those on the conservative side of the aisle. Indeed, it just leads to divisiveness with those who want to evaluate someone individually when BLM deliberately elevates those individuals who have the least a favorable resume in their biography or their background. But that's what happened when the media elevated the Black Panther Party as well, particularly people like Eldridge Cleaver, particularly books like Soul on Ice, particularly celebrating gangsters and gangster culture that became such a key core component of urban African-American defined experience that now it says to be a man, you should go out and loot, you should go out and riot, you should go out and commit crime, you should become some sort of high-level drug dealer or the rest. It celebrated the worst potential component or worst potential opportunity for African-American experience rather than promoting it and protecting it. Long ago, Ralph Ellison brilliantly wrote about this in his book, The Invisible Man. In fact, it would be his first and last great novel because he was defining himself, going through all these different groups from left to right that could not see him as a man. They could only see his color and that's it. And whether it was, and particularly when it was on the left, not just on the right. He expected it from the right of the 1950s. He did not expect it from the left of the 1950s, but it's what he experienced. And that's why his book is so hauntingly true to this day. David Horowitz himself, a former leftist, would leave because it was his bookkeeper he put into the Black Panther Party to help organize and protect their books for this social experiment he thought was good and helpful for a local school system that ended up dead. That's where liberal dreams go. That's where radical ideas go.